Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, healthcare reform is just around the corner. How prepared is Fresno County and the Central Valley to implement the Affordable Healthcare Act? Finally, money to open the new veterans home. What will it mean to Valley vets? And California has a new national park. Find out where it is and what it offers. But first, the Fresno area lags behind other parts of the state in preparing for health care reform. That's according to a new report from the California Healthcare Foundation. A panel of local and national experts will gather at Fresno State later today to discuss this important issue. We will talk to the co-author of the study, Dr. Peter Cunningham, who will also be the keynote speaker at today's event. But we begin with this report. When it comes to implementing President Obama's health care law, Valley counties are taking remarkably different routes in expanding coverage to their poorest residents. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plavin reports on how Tulare County is about to launch a low-income health program that Fresno County declined.
In less than 1 year, the federal health care law will take effect. When that happens, an estimated 1.4 million low-income, uninsured adults in California will become eligible for Medicaid. Let me repeat that number. 1.4 million people. That's a huge number of people who will suddenly be eligible for health benefits and better access to health care.
Right now, Medicaid covers children, parents, seniors, and people with disabilities, but it doesn't cover adults without kids at home, even if they're penniless.
Anthony Wright is the executive director of Health Access, a statewide health care consumer advocacy coalition.
The Affordable Care Act plugs that huge hole in our safety net in 2014, and it has an option for states to do that expansion early.
The option Wright mentioned is called the Low Income Health Program and is considered a bridge to health reform. The program allows counties to get a jump start at enrolling poor people in insurance and providing them with basic health benefits. It utilizes the dollars that counties already spend on indigent care and is supported by matching funds from the federal government. So far, 51 of 58 counties have implemented this program, but several San Joaquin Valley counties have dragged their feet.
The Central Valley can be described as ground zero for the uninsured crisis nationally. You have a very high uninsured rate. Close to a quarter of adults are uninsured. And so there is a huge need for the expanded coverage in the Affordable Care Act.
Despite the need, Wright is not surprised that some Valley counties have not implemented this program.
It is expected but ironic that the counties that have taken the most advantage are the ones with developed safety nets, public hospitals, community clinics, and the ones that have been lagging behind in taking advantage of the low-income health program are those that had less developed safety nets.
Kern County was one of the first in the state to pilot a version of the program. San Joaquin County has implemented one, too. But Fresno County, the largest county in the region, was the first in the state to turn down the opportunity completely.
Tulare County is looking at implementing a low-income health program primarily because we feel like that it's a bridge to health care reform, and it will assist us in getting our system and our community ready for Medicaid expansion to occur in 2014.
Jason Britt is the Director of Human Services at the Tulare County Health and Human Services Agency. His county aims to implement its version of the program in March. It will serve an estimated 3,000 to 5,000 poor people who live at or below 75% of the federal poverty level. For an individual, that works out to an annual income of about $8,300. For a family of four, that's a little over $17,000 a year. County staff working in emergency rooms and federally qualified health centers will screen people and determine if they are eligible for the program. If they are eligible, they will choose a primary care physician, connect to a network of specialists, and gain basic health benefits.
The low-income health program offers a core package of services that include things like medical equipment and supplies, emergency care services, which may also include transportation, inpatient hospital services, laboratory services. There are some mental health benefits that are authorized in this program, physical therapy, podiatry services, prescription medication, prosthetic and orthotic appliances and devices.
Britt believes the greatest benefit of the program is that it will help people develop the habit of visiting a primary care physician instead of the emergency room. That's why he believes it's worth implementing, even if it lasts just for a couple of months.
It gets our indigent population connected with a medical home. Typically, this population that we're targeting typically only seeks services when they're needed. And so getting them connected to a medical home, getting them connected to a primary care physician, getting them the preventive medicine that they need to be healthy and productive members of society is really the benefit we see to this program.
But Fresno County residents won't gain these benefits until the healthcare law takes effect next January. That's because the Fresno County Board of Supervisors voted against implementing the program in October 2011. Their decision still frustrates Kevin Hamilton. He's the Deputy Chief of Programs for Clínica Sierra Vista. He says that if the program had been implemented, poor people would have already gained access to health care.
They would have been provided with access to a medical home so that they'd have a primary care provider. We could have already started seeing the reductions in emergency room visits for things like sore throats, headaches, colds, and the associated costs with those ER visits like ambulance, transportation, more missed work, and missed days of school for kids and things like that.
Hamilton is concerned that without the support of a low-income health program, Fresno County won't be prepared to enroll newly eligible people into Medicaid beginning October 1st. Sonia Kovacevic is a deputy director for the Fresno County Department of Social Services. She says it might have been easier to prepare for the upcoming Medicaid expansion if the county had created a low-income health program.
From the social services department standpoint, if we did the LIHP piece, it would have actually, we would have taken a portion of the population and have already kind of figured out the eligibility piece that in some ways would have made our Preparation for Affordable Care Act, and that's a sort of a big maybe, or depending on how we did the eligibility piece.
But she's not looking back. The county faces a huge to-do list as the first day of Medicaid enrollment approaches.
I think the biggest issue for us will be just the volume and needing to really recognize that we will need more staff to deal with the increase.
Right of Health Access says Valley counties should seize the chance to ensure more people gain access to health insurance.
Especially for Central Valley counties, which have such a high uninsured rate, this provides a new framework, new funds to address some long-standing issues with regard to health care, but it's only if they take advantage of these opportunities. And so what's needed is a commitment to seize these opportunities moving forward.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Now, the conference at Fresno State surrounding the idea of whether the San Joaquin Valley is ready to take on health reform will take place later today. Joining us now is Dr. Peter Cunningham. He is the co-author of the study. He's also senior fellow and director of quantitative research, the Center for Studying Health System Change. Dr. Cunningham will be part of the panel discussion. The topic is Fresno ready for healthcare reform. That panel discussion taking place later this afternoon at the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. Dr. Cunningham, thank you for taking some time to talk to us about this important issue.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Now, as we heard in Rebecca's report, this region, specifically Fresno County, seems not to be prepared to implement health care reform. What can that mean for the residents, especially those who will now be eligible for Medicaid?
Well, I think what it's going to mean is that when the Affordable Care Act is implemented beginning in October of this year, that that residents may have a little bit more difficult time figuring out what kind of coverage they're going to be eligible for, how to enroll, and then once they enroll, where are they supposed to go to for health care. I think perhaps one of the biggest risks is that what you're going to see is that once people start enrolling, they may crowd the emergency departments, the emergency rooms, because they don't necessarily have primary care providers that either were assigned to them or that they're familiar with and they can go to.
Well, you know, in an area that is already suffering from a lack of affordable health care, that could really end up being quite difficult, not only for those seeking health care, but for those agencies. They're going to be overwhelmed.
They're going to be overwhelmed, but they may not have the staff to handle the volume. And the other thing about Fresno County that makes it difficult for health reform is that there's already a pretty big shortage of health care providers, especially primary care physicians. I mean, this is a long-standing issue, and it's particularly acute out in the more rural areas. And so the danger or the problem is that there's going to be this big surge in demand for medical care, and the county is not going to be ready for it. It's already difficult if you're on Medi-Cal or if you're uninsured to see a private practice physician. And again, what's probably going to happen is that the hospital's emergency rooms are probably going to see a surge in visits.
You know, we're going to come back to that issue in just a moment. But looking at your study, you studied a number of areas in the state. And what was the difference between those who prepared for health care reform by implementing the low-income health plan and those who didn't? What did you see when you compared the regions?
Well, In a lot of the areas that implemented the low-income health program, they used it not only to expand coverage to more low-income people, but they used it to change the delivery of health care in the sense that they're providing people with a medical home, they're linking people up with the area's community health centers so that people not only have coverage, they have a place to go to, a place that will provide them with the basics, preventive care, screening, diagnosis, and then be able to act as a source of referral for more specialty care. And so that's really one of the things that we've seen in the other communities that we've studied is that they've not only taken this low-income health program and expanded coverage, but they've really used it to try to reform the delivery system in a way that really makes it more of a patient-centered medical home.
Now, did the fact that the healthcare system in the Central Valley, as you touched on a moment ago, is already inadequate, do you think that impacted some of the county's decision, not to move ahead with the low-income health program?
Well, our understanding of the issue that was kind of at the heart of the decision was the concern about whether it would also lead to an increase in the county's medically indigent program, because undocumented immigrants are not going to be eligible for the low-income health program, and they're not going to be eligible for Medi-Cal when that expands in 2014. But the concern of the county, because they have this agreement with community medical centers to provide all of the county's indigent care, is that it would actually increase the amount of indigent care, and that neither the county nor community medical center felt that they would be able to afford it. So I think the issue is more about indigent care and specifically care of the undocumented population. That was kind of at the heart of the decision not to participate in the low-income health program.
You know, but that is something this county is going to have to deal with sooner or later. You know, the Affordable Health Care Act is just right around the corner.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's especially a problem in the Fresno area because it's a rural agricultural area. There are a lot of immigrant populations. And one of the loopholes in the coverage expansions, again, is that both recent immigrants and undocumented immigrants are not eligible for the coverage expansions. but they still need health care, and it's still going to be the county's responsibility to provide health care to the indigent population, and that is an expense. So I think the county, and this is a problem not just for Fresno, but I think statewide, is that the county has to figure out a better way to provide indigent care.
Couldn't the low-income health plan sort of help with that transition of that?
Well, sure, because what they, again, what other areas in the state have done is that they've used the low-income health program to transform the delivery system so that it's much more of a patient-centered medical home. People are assigned primary care providers, and you have a much more efficient, higher quality system rather than people going to the emergency rooms. And while people who enrolled in the low-income health program or Medi-Cal will certainly benefit from that, I think it's also the remaining uninsured and medically indigent population would benefit from that as well.
Now, as we heard in our report, Tulare County is implementing the low-income health program, albeit late. But Fresno County, as we've also talked about, has really done nothing. How would a regional approach, could this area have taken a regional approach to this? Would that have been better?
Well, I think it would have been difficult on a regional to take a more regional approach as far as the low-income health program, because three of the counties, Mariposa, Madera, and Kings County, they're rural counties, and they participate in the low-income health program through the Path to Health. This was something that the state created for rural counties who really didn't have enough population to create their own low-income health program. And so in California, the county has historically been the level of government that's been responsible for indigent care, as well as the implementation of the low-income health program. And so it's kind of so I think in terms of the participation in that, each county really had to do their own thing. And certainly, given that there are commonalities across some of the counties, they could take a more regional approach to other things, especially in terms of the providers of care to Medi-Cal and the medically indigent coordinating their care. But again, it's a pretty vast geographic region, and I think it's difficult in even the best of circumstances for providers to come together and kind of figure out how they're going to work together on these things.
You know, one of the issues you mentioned or factors you mentioned in your study was just the lack of a strong HMO presence here in this area. I mean, you take that and you combine that with the doctor shortage that we already have. What kind of impact is that going to have on implementing any kind of health care reform package?
Well, the impact that it, I mean, I guess the first thing is how is it helping counties or communities where there is a strong HMO presence? And what it does is that in places like San Francisco, San Diego, Sacramento, is because the Kaiser Health Plan and other HMOs have already created this sort of integrated healthcare system that includes hospitals as well as primary care physicians, it's kind of becoming a catalyst for other entities, other providers in the area to do the same, because it's not only the Affordable Care Act is not only expanding health insurance coverage, but other provisions of the act give a lot more emphasis on creating incentives to provide better quality care at lower costs, and this means doctors and hospitals working more closely together. And Kaiser and the Kaiser Health Plan and other HMOs have already sort of done that, and so it's so even prior to the Affordable Care Act, it already sort of spurred that kind of activity in other communities. Whereas in Fresno, it has a weaker presence of HMOs and Kaisers, And so in contrast to other parts of the state, physicians tend to be a lot more independent. They tend to be more resistant to the kinds of closer relationships with hospitals and other providers that we've seen in other parts of the states.
You also mentioned that the physician practices here have been really kind of slow to organize in anticipation of healthcare reform. What are the implications of that?
The Fresno area is probably behind other communities in terms of forming these new types of delivery systems, which are commonly called accountable care organizations. And again, these are entities that are now being emphasized in the Affordable Care Act as well as the Medicare program. And again, they come in many different forms, but again, the idea is that it incentivizes doctors and hospitals to work together in order to provide higher quality care at lower costs. And again, the fact that physicians tend to be more independent, they tend to work in smaller practices in the Fresno area, they tend to resist the types of closer cooperation with hospitals that we see in other areas. This means that it's going to be more difficult to form these organizations, these accountable care organizations in Fresno, and they're going to be somewhat behind other parts of the state in those activities.
You know, but we have seen an expansion of what are called federally qualified healthcare clinics here, and also some rural healthcare clinics. But do we have enough of those?
No. I mean, that's true pretty much across the state. I would say Fresno, the Fresno area, including the city as well as the rural areas, there is a pretty robust network of federally qualified health centers, and these serve primarily uninsured as well as Medi-Cal patients, to some extent Medicare, and a little bit of commercially insured. But they have been expanding as a result of the stimulus funding, the federal stimulus funding that came through in about 2009, as well as more funding through the Affordable Care Act. But I think everywhere you go, not only Fresno, but other parts of California and other parts of the country, they'll say, yes, we're expanding, but we're not expanding fast enough to meet the needs. So I think, and because the economy has been tough, the number of uninsured has increased, the number of Medi-Cal patients has increased, that's just the demand for those kinds of services has increased much faster than those facilities have been able to expand their capacity.
And, you know, just sort of continuing that discussion when you talked about how the economy has impacted so many individuals and so many families, because there's a lot of focus here on, you know, the low income and what needs to be done. But what about people who now, because of their own economic situation or because of the new guidelines, who are now eligible for Medicaid, and maybe they haven't accessed health care at a clinic before or some other method? Does more need to be done to kind of educate those individuals as far as what might be available to them now?
Yeah, and I think part of that, can happen through there's a local managed care plan for Medi-Cal enrollees called CalViva. And that was created several years ago by the three counties. I believe it was Fresno, Madera, and Kings County got together to do that. And again, it's a managed care plan. And so what happens is that when people are enrolled, they're asked to select a primary care provider, or they are assigned a primary care provider. And that acts as a medical home, which then can coordinate all of the services, all of the healthcare services that that person may need, including prescription drugs, specialty care. And so that's really the emphasis in healthcare policy these days, not only for the low-income population, but for healthcare in general, is to have a more patient-centered medical home delivery system, and less fragmented care, less reliance on emergency rooms for the more routine acute care needs.
And so all of these, I assume, issues and more of your study, that's going to be the topic of the panel discussion. You have assembled a very informed panel to talk about this issue?
Yes. It's a panel that's going to be comprised of the policymakers in the community, as well as some of the healthcare providers and other organizations that are involved in the healthcare system. And so, this really kind of exemplifies the purpose of the study and why we do it and why it's funded by the California Healthcare Foundation, is to really provide analysis of the healthcare system and to stimulate discussion in the community about some of the issues that are going on, not only some of the long-standing issues, but about preparations that are being made for health reform, as well as the challenges that are being made for health reform in the community.
How do you think this can help this area better prepare for healthcare reform?
Well, I think the main thing that I can do is just to compare the Fresno area with the other five communities in California that we've looked at, and that includes San Diego, San Francisco, L.A., Sacramento, and Riverside, San Bernardino, and to say, here's how Fresno is similar, here's how it's different, and here's some of the special challenges that we see in Fresno and some of the surrounding counties in terms of implementing reform. I think that's really what I consider my role to be, is to give them some perspective on the kinds of challenges that Fresno is facing and how that compares with the rest of the state as well as other parts of the nation.
And, you know, as we wrap this up, that's the final question I'd like to ask you. You know, knowing what you know through your research of this area, and as we move into implementing the Affordable Health Care Act, what are we facing here in the Central Valley?
Well, I think, like I said, the two biggest challenges that I see in the Central Valley is a shortage of healthcare providers. Now, that's not unique. That's something that we see all across the country. In some places, it's worse than others. But potentially, you're going to see a big surge in the demand for medical care when the reform is implemented starting in October of this year. And in an area that already has provider shortages, this is only going to make the situation worse, and that could have some impact on the emergency rooms in the area, the hospital emergency rooms in the area. So I think that's going to be one of the bigger challenges, and the fact that the county was one of the few not to participate in the low-income health program, which really gave California a head start. California has been one of the leaders in getting a head start on the health care reform. So in some respects, Fresno is going to be much like the rest of the nation that has done nothing or very little to prepare for reform in terms of, there's going to be a learning curve, and it's going to take time to sort of figure it out, sort it out, and, handle the surge in demand and, hopefully find a way to address the provider shortages, because I see that as really one of the biggest challenges over the next few years as this reform is implemented.
Dr. Peter Cunningham, thank you so much for your time. And if you want to hear more about this discussion, again, there's a panel discussion call. Is Fresno Ready for Healthcare Reform? Takes place later this afternoon, starting at 3 p.m. at the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State. Thank you, Dr. Cunningham.
Thank you.
You are listening to Valley Public Radio. This is Valley Edition with Juanita Stevenson. We'll be right back.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Anita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Well, it took more than a decade to get it built, then it sat empty for almost another year due to lack of funding. But this year, in his proposed budget, Governor Jerry Brown has set aside $27 million for the veterans' homes, both in Fresno and Redding. What will that mean for Valley veterans? Here to discuss this issue with us is Nazara Tackett, Assistant Administrator at the Fresno Veterans Home, and Charlie Waters, a veterans advocate and president of the Central Cala Veterans Home Support Foundation. And Charlie has worked tirelessly to get this veterans home built. So I'll start with you, Charlie. Finally, how does this feel to you, knowing that you're going to finally be able to open?
Well, it's great. It's needed. And even though it's taken a few years, 12, I guess we're on our 12th year, we had to overcome obstacles that we never dreamt were out there. The VA, 12 years ago, they had a committee, and the committee took something like 5 or 6 months. And they didn't find a site even. So we formed the foundation, and those of us, there were probably 7 or 8 of us in the beginning, met at a tea house and discussed it and decided that we would fight this no matter how long it took. And unfortunately, two of the initial designers of this, the guys that were desirous of having this home and really felt it was a need, with George Sinopoli and Chuck Parnell, and they both passed away in the past 4 or 5 years. So those of us that were part of it just kind of took the challenge and carried through. We had to find the land that was acceptable by the federal and the state, VA. Then we had to fight the zoning. Then we had to start really getting into the nitty-gritty of going. And we went to Washington and did a couple of hearings with the VA. And it was interesting, the reaction that we got. Why do you need one in Fresno? Where's Fresno? But they soon learned where Fresno was when we brought a map the second hearing and showed him right in the middle of California. And there were, there's several thousand veterans in Central California.
Yeah, home to a lot of veterans.
Yes, and so I used a figure, right, wrong, or indifferent. I had to do something that scared the bejesus out of them to let them know that we were a significant amount of veterans. And we said, well, there's 300,000 veterans in Central California. Well, since then, we found out there's 2 point some million in the state. No. But calculating the central part of the state, we figured, well, 300,000 wasn't a bad number. So, but anyhow, it worked. And through hearings and more hearings and disappointments, I can't tell you how many disappointments there were. But we did realize that money was the crux of all of this. Without the money, you have no building, no staff, no nothing. So we've gone through the governor's steps with the different governors that have come in and gone. And finally, thank goodness, we were very, very pleased when the governor announced through the VA that we would be not only building the home, but at some point opening it. Well, it was very disappointing. We've had ups and downs this whole 12 years. Oh, all the way. Something's going to happen, then something isn't going to happen. So we demanded, and we had hearings. And at some of the hearings, the politicos from the other end of the state, from the north and the south, said, well, why, we're going to have the homes here. Why should you have it in Fresno? There's nothing but farms and agriculture there. And of course, we explained there was just a few more things than farms and agriculture here. There's a couple of good colleges and some other important industry. So It's just we worked out everything.
Yeah.
And then we were really pleased when they announced that they had the building finished. And I'll tell you, I wouldn't trade anything to be in the seat of the guys that were selling us the goods, because when they came, the architects and the others came to us, we stretched the dollars till they screamed. I mean, if you go to that home, you can see it's not a standard nursing.
No, it's a wonderful building. Nazera, we say he's proposed the funding. Is everybody confident that the funding is going to come through?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Because a lot of times, you know how we've had to deal with the California budget. So when will the home actually open?
Our goal is the fall of this year. We have a lot to do between now and then. Currently, there's only 8 employees there, which is one of the reasons we're having the hiring fair next week on January the 23rd for anybody that would like to come out. It's between the hours of 8 and 4. We need to hire approximately 100 people before we open. So we have an enormous amount of work to do. We have licensing agencies that have to come and give us the thumbs up before we can have anybody reside there. But that is our goal, and we will do whatever it takes to make sure that we can get some residents through that door in the fall of this year.
Now, first of all, who will be the first, I want to say patients or residents, who will be allowed to use this veterans home?
The criteria for a veteran to enter into a state of California veterans home is you simply have to be a veteran with some sort of need. At the Fresno Veterans Home, we have 2 levels of care. We have what's called residential care for the elderly, is also known as assisted living. And then we will have skilled nursing care as well. So the veteran would need to have some sort of long-term care needs. Other than that, they just need to be a veteran who is honorably discharged.
So possibly all age levels.
Possibly all age levels, yes. It is a veterans home for a senior population. So we put an age soft parameter of age 55. So California residency, age 55, honorably discharged, and, of course, a veteran.
Now, how will the patients be chosen?
Well, there's an application process that they'll have to go through, so they have to complete the applications. And once those are received, there is a team that starts reviewing those, and they will be chosen through that. The application process is a little bit lengthy, and it requires a doctor visit or a doctor certification, if you will. But once we get the completed application, then we'll start the selection process for the home.
What kind of, when we talk about the patients and how they're going to be chosen, I'm sure because of the need here that you probably expect the need to really, outdistance the how many people you'll be able to serve right away.
The need obviously in the Central Valley is greater than what we will be able to accommodate initially, but because the home is finally here, we hope to be able to diminish that need in a great capacity at some point. That's part of our mission. That's part of our goal to serve veterans and to provide them premium health care.
And you mentioned, you started to talk about that a little, Mr. Waters, and that is the construction of the home. It's for a veterans home, it's really one of the ones that has been talked about as far as the construction and what all is involved with that.
Yeah, it was, they had to follow the guidelines for the, first I guess the feds came involved and then the state, the guidelines that they use for a facility. And we wanted it a little more. In other words, a lot of these people will spend the last hours of their life there, and we have something there that not every veteran's home in the country has. That's where when a person is preparing to pass, we have 5 suites one in each one of, I used to call them pods. Mm-hmm. Now it's a living facility.
Neighborhoods.
Neighborhood. It's a neighborhood now. Yeah, we have to get used to the terminology. Where the family will come and they can be with their warrior as he passes. Mm-hmm. And we demanded, we did not want this to be a gray or a warehouse. I mean, we didn't want a place that, well, it's got rooms and a cafeteria and that's it. We wanted the room, the hallway, where they eat, where they walk, to be somewhat similar, something comfortable, something just not gray. We wanted it to be of multiple colors. We wanted it to be absolutely a place of comfort, a place that they want to come back to when they went out or go out to an event.
Okay. And Nazara, if you could just follow up on that, because I think Mr. Waters kind of mentioned it. It seems like there are some really unique designs or offerings in this facility. It looks like you mentioned there's hospice care, or
there will be hospice care. Yes, he was speaking of. We have the rooms for hospice care are extraordinarily large. It could probably fit 10, 20 family members if needed, which is a great part of our homes. The colors are warm. They're inviting. The things that have been incorporated into a long-term care facility, like just simple things like the handrails that some of our residents will need, are of a beautiful wood tones. There's wood tones and rock. We have covered walkways everywhere for when the residents need to be outside. We have enclosed hallways for the residents that will be coming and going from the skilled nursing areas. So they really took a lot of time and effort into the design of the home to make sure that that multiple needs, not just the health care, but just the overall well-being of our residents will be met.
Mr. Waters, how important is that? Because you talked about that, especially for a veterans and for the veterans' family in their last days, to be able to pass with dignity, especially after all they've done for the country.
Well, that was one of the major considerations at the beginning when we met with the architects that the state had hired, and the people who worked for the state. We had things that we had to meet, codes that we had to meet, and so anyway, we had the architect bring in the wood, even the fabric for the chairs, the coloring of the facility. And we had some knock down, drag out discussions about what we could do with this building that we were preparing to build, rather than just paint the thing navy gray and put beds in there and a chair next to the bed and maybe a stand. Mm-hmm. No, that's unacceptable. We wanted it to be when the veteran wanted to go to his room, he would be there in something that would resemble a home. The rooms are large enough. The showers are there. For heck, if you wanted to sit in a chair and wheel into the,
And they're all private rooms, which is a large private step forward for the veterans.
Oh yes,
homes.
Big step. You don't have to share restrooms with another person and bang on the door every 20 minutes.
What are some of the services that are going to be offered there, other than just the residency?
Well, of course, 3 meals a day and snacks. We will have activity directors and recreational therapists there. We have a very large physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy center. We have a primary care clinic. The residents, if they choose, can have their primary care taken care of there. We have a bocce ball court. We have a shuffleboard court. We have a putting green. So there's hopefully there'll be multiple things that will keep our residents both happy and as independent as possible.
How do you think this veterans home here, because we're talking about the entire Central Valley, how do you think it will affect the region? Both of you can touch on that.
Well, I think definitely, first of all, when it's in full bloom, 400 employees is a significant stimulus to the community. And these jobs are prime. I mean, you know, they're mostly, once you go to work, you work your entire working career there. So that'll enhance the work ability in Fresno. But it's going to be someplace where when a veteran is up in years, a veteran does not need to be sent away from his family, away from his friends, away from everything he's known. He needs to be closer. I know there's some discussion about the life of the vet, the term, how long should they live. And I'm totally very, very, very against this kind of conversation. I'm saying let the human being live his or her full life and make it as comfortable as we can for them. And you need to be near where a friend can visit, a family can visit. You don't feel like you've been stuck away someplace, and psychologically you go downhill. I mean, we've paid that price when we first joined the service and got sent away for years at a time. So the ones that are going to be there and being taken care of by Nazara and her crew, I feel, I can't tell you how comfortable I feel as one of the veteran leaders to have people like Nazara coming, being put into the situation, because they work with you. They understand where these people are coming from, that they're going to be taken care of, and that's so important. They're not saying, oh, we've got some rooms in the desert, so we're going to put you down in Mojave there and let you sweat out for 5 or 6 years. No, they're going to be here in the valley. They're going to be home. And also, the community is reacting beautifully to this home, because we're going to have veterans go to ball games. We're going to have them at the Grizzlies. We're going to have them at the ballet, the opera. We're not going to let them sit there and deteriorate. That's what our foundation's for, to assist.
Be part of the community.
To be part of the community.
Now, you mentioned, excuse me, eventually 400 in employees, right? I think 300,
yes.
400.
Approximately, yes.
But you're going to start with how many, and let's talk a little bit about what is needed and the job fair.
The job fair, well, before we have any residents, as I mentioned, we need to hire somewhere between 70 and 100 employees.
What kind of people are you looking for? What positions?
We're looking for, our medical positions, our nursing positions, CNAs, LVNs, and RNs. That hiring should begin around June and July. We also have a medical records department, procurement department, food service. I need an enormous – the kitchen there is absolutely beautiful, and we need to serve our veterans three, you know, excellent meals a day. We need a high number of food service personnel. Administrative positions, general services positions, custodial, housekeeping, sanitation. What else? I'm blanking out, of course, right now. But at the job fair, we will have a workshop for people that have had difficulty in the past or are not familiar with the state hiring process. It can be a little bit complex your first time. We'll also have subject matter experts available from all of our disciplines that can answer questions, assist with the application process, and we'll even have some examinations. With the state process, you must take an exam or a qualifications appraisal prior to being able to interview, and those there will be some of those actually administered on site that day.
Now, this is going to be where?
It will be actually held at the Fresno Veterans Home.
Oh, that'd be great. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
People will get the opportunity to see it as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That sounds great. I'd like to thank you both for coming.
I think
a lot of people are looking forward to this. Again, just so we'll remember, the job fair is on the 23rd, but actually opening the Veterans Home with the staff will be right around when?
In the fall.
In the fall?
In the fall.
That's what you're aiming toward.
Yes. That is our goal.
Okay, thank you both. Nazara Tackett, Assistant Administrator at the Fresno Veterans Home, and Charlie Waters, he's a Veterans Advocate and President of the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation. Thank you both for coming in today. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Welcome back. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, the country has a new national park. Last week, President Obama signed bills creating Pinnacles National Park, which is located near Salinas in San Benito County. That is 26,000 acres for the public to enjoy. Here to tell us more about the nation's and California's newest national park is Annette Kondo with the Wilderness Society. Thank you so much, Annette, for joining us.
Oh, good morning, Juanita. Thanks for having me.
Well, good. Tell us about this. This is really exciting that it's not something that happens every day. Tell us a little bit about the park and
Sure. What
will people see there. When you read about it, it sounds beautiful.
It really is interesting. Well, first of all, it has been a national monument, and it was recognized for, you know, its unique features quite a long time ago. Actually, it goes back to 1908 when President Theodore Roosevelt decided to create a national monument to protect this place. So it's filled with these rocky spires and caves and California condors. It's kind of this spectacular place where it's a mixture of sort of volcanic landscape, but also you have oak plateaus and savannas, creeks, and you have these incredible bat caves with some threatened bat species, and you have also more than 400 species of bees.
Wow. Now, people, this is an area where people will be able to come and hike and...
Well, yes, obviously it's a hiker's destination, but because of the name, Pinnacles, that's exactly what they are. They're these sort of like church-like spires that go into the sky. So it's a really popular place with rock climbers as well. But we've found that there's been tremendous interest in Pinnacles, you know, as a national monument first, and now as a national park because of the California condors, which are an endangered species, a very rare species that almost completely died out here in California. And what's remarkable is that there are about 31 condors that can be seen, and they are they wear radio collars, but they fly freely, and they are often seen there in the park. In fact, a baby chick was hatched there, you know, in 2010, and that was a big deal because it had been more than a century since that had happened, so that was really exciting for them.
Oh, sounds great. Well, as you mentioned, this was a state monument. What did it take for it to become a park?
Yes. Well, it was a national monument ever since, as I mentioned, President Roosevelt declared it a national monument. So it was, you know, known as a place to come. But when it comes to upgrading it to a national park, it required legislation. And, you know, we really have to give a big hand and applause to Representative Sam Farr and Senator Barbara Boxer. Now, Representative Sam Farr out of Salinas, he has been a long-time champion of upgrading Pinnacles National Monument to a national park. So he introduced legislation in 2009. It wasn't able to get through the Congress, but he reintroduced that in 2011. And we're so excited that in this just past Congress, the 112th, Senator Barbara Boxer helped to get that legislation through. So it made it through the House, the Senate, and we're just so excited because, obviously, last week President Obama signed it into legislation.
And it's my understanding in the House there, you know, was a rare example of bipartisanship because, if I'm not mistaken, the Valley's representative, Congressman Dunham, and I think another congressman from Carmel kind of also worked with this measure.
Yes. Representative Farr's measure was co-sponsored by Representative Jeff Denham, so that was very helpful. And, you know, just getting it through the House was critical. That was the first step. And then, as you mentioned, when Senator Boxer, she introduced her version of the bill, but she actually had to help get Representative Farr's bill through because his bill had made it through the House. So that was, again, you're right, a clear example of bipartisanship and a wonderful one because, really, everyone benefits from this. And the, and one of the things that we don't know too much about, because maybe people think, oh, it's a national park, it's a great place to visit, but a really important factor is the fact that this really benefits local communities, and that is a huge draw for tourists, for travelers. You know, they may stop and see a national monument, but boy, when there's a national park near them, they will definitely make that detour. So we have communities like the San Benito Chamber of Commerce and local mayors all really supporting Representative Farr's legislation and asking Senator Boxer to help get this through. And these communities, you know, in this, in these hard times, boy, those hotels and gas stations and restaurants, they can all benefit from having a national park in their community, because we know that that's going to draw more national as well as foreign tourists, because it's not that far, you know, off the highway to come to Pinnacles.
No, it's my understanding from what I've read, the natural preserves portion of this was pulled out of the park funding. Does that have any kind of impact at all?
Well, there is. Here's some good news. There is some good news, and there's a little bit of bittersweet news. In Pinnacles National Park, it's 26,000 acres, the national park. But within that, about 16,000 acres are wilderness, and these are areas that are left, you know, untouched. No roads, no buildings, no cell phone towers. We were hoping to add to that wilderness within the park. So in Farr's original bill, there was supposed to be another 3,000 acres set aside as wilderness. Unfortunately, that provision of his 2011 bill was stripped out in the House Resources Committee. So the monument did become a national park, but a tiny extra piece of land within the park that could have been protected as wilderness did not happen. So, you know, we are disappointed with that, but we're very excited that there still is a national park. So I am happy to say that, you know, more than half of Pinnacles National Park has wilderness inside. So, you know, we are still going to be able to see those natural areas without roads, you know, without any other intrusion on that land.
Wow, that sounds great. And for people who live here in the Central Valley, just where is it located so they'll know if they want to go visit?
Sure. Well, it is not very far from Soledad. It is, you know, basically really close to Soledad, and a lot of people come in from that entrance. You can also come in through the Hollister area from that side of the park as well. And what's exciting is that they've already made improvements to some of these visitor entryways, so we're already starting to see, you know, more services for tourists and travelers. You can learn, you know, more about the fascinating, you know, volcanic and tectonic plate history that created these incredible rock formations. And you can learn more about how it's just this really a center of biodiversity. I mentioned the 400 species of bees and the threatened bats that live in the bat caves and, of course, the condors. But there's all kinds of wildlife here. And just, you know, all your visitors from the Central Valley, it's kind of a hidden gem, because once you enter this place, you really are in a different world. You know, it's a completely unique little treasure that we have here in California.
Well, thank you so much. Something else to look forward to here in the Valley. Annette Kondo with the Wilderness Society, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Juanita.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.